There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. There's a bit of a trend going on in the museum world. Museums are unionizing. And not just because of a renewed interest in labor unions after the release of Martin Scorsese's Jimmy Hoffa movie, The Irishman. Granted, most of the museums taking part in this trend are in one of the places you might expect, New York and California. But it's a shift in the industry that can't be ignored. One of the museums to recently organize is the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum in Manhattan. We recently spoke to Andres Puerta, director of special projects for the IUOE Local 30. Andres worked with the Guggenheim during this process. So tell me a little bit of the history of how the organization at the Guggenheim started and the seeds that were planted to kind of get the wheels in motion to getting all this going.
So a couple of years ago, we organized... You know, we've had, MoMA has been a union contract for many years now, and MoMA's obviously one of the standard bearers in the cultural industry, which you can call it now, in New York City. So a couple of years ago, I'd say 3 or 4 years ago, we organized very similar installers, many of them artists themselves, that work at PS1 MoMA, which is in Long Island City, Queens.
This is a satellite museum of the main MoMA.
This is correct. Yes, it's a satellite museum. They have independent boards. It's a part of MoMA, very loosely part of MoMA. But you know what makes this interesting is all of the these installers. The art community in New York City is very close knit. Everybody knows each other, and it's a really strong and vibrant community. And so when we organized PS1, from there we really started planting the seed about the Guggenheim. The Guggenheim's the last standing significant institution in New York City that has not been unionized. And so for several years, we've connected, workers from PS1, from MoMA, with their counterparts at the Guggenheim, and really slowly built an organization there. And then in January of last year, the organization started to grow, and these workers at the Guggenheim started asking questions about their compensation, about their work rules, about their futures, and their standing in the community. And so from there, we met with the workers quietly in the middle of installs, near the museum. We had very small meetings. It grew from there. And by May, I'd say, the workers are ready to demand their union. And it was a really beautiful campaign.
Talk about what kinds of demands and agreements that museum workers across the board, from PS1 to Guggenheim, there's sure there's similarities about, kind of standards of what people are expecting. What kind of things are they wanting to bring the union in to help improve their lives?
So these are, these trade union agreements really get into the, nitty gritty of work rules, right? And so that's everything from, hey, when do I start getting paid overtime, to obviously wages, to some sort of benefit structure, to what happens if they get called in right after a shift. Oftentimes these institutions are running the Guggenheim 7 days a week. And so some of these workers get called 2 days in advance to come in and work. I'll give you an example specific to the Guggenheim. They would be scheduled, to come into work from Thursday to Sunday, 10 hours a day. And so they wouldn't get any overtime because that was, 40 hours in a week that they were working, very long days doing very difficult work. and working on the weekends for what they call straight time pay. And the workers said, when they were, when you know, we were unionizing, this just isn't acceptable anymore. If they worked, you know, for an install, if they worked 12 hours, 14 hours, and they were reaching the 40-hour threshold, the museum would say to them, okay, well, you know, we don't need you to come in tomorrow, explicitly for the purpose of, you know, not crossing the overtime threshold. And so all of these little work rules really are about a culture. Are workers respected? Is their work respected at the museum? What kind of voice do they have? What kind of control do they have over their own work lives? And the answer was, frankly, zero. As is true in most non-union places, barring anything egregious, everyone's an at-will employee. You're there because management wants you to be there, and you can, you know, be let go or your hours cut for any reason. And the workers wanted some control. And so that's why they unionized. So yes, wages matter, of course, benefits matter. But, you know, overtime rules matter and safety matters and having a voice in working conditions and the, you know, the safe environment at the museum matters. And ultimately, it's about respect. And that's why they unionized.
Well, it seems like, you know, a phrase we hear a lot in today's world is the work-life balance. And it seems like a lot of these things are there to formalize a way to actually give people that, to give people a sense of a kind of balance and security in their workplace.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so this, the art community in New York City, again, is incredibly vibrant, very close-knit. It is absolutely an industry here. You know, the Guggenheim's receipts are upwards near $75 million a year, you know, at least in revenue. The receipts are higher than that. It's a significant cultural property and cultural facility. And so, you know, the workers bounce from museums to museums trying to make a living while they follow their passion. Most of them, like I said, are artists. And, you know, so they realize at some point that, wow, they're, you know, they're working at these significant, high-grossing revenue institutions, and they're barely getting by. And so they struggle to get different install gigs while they do their art on the side, and they have to pay rent, right?
Yeah.
And they have to be home if they have families, and they have to follow their own dreams in art, and it all has to be worth it. And unless they come together and demand better, they're not going to get that. And so that's why they're joining our union. Because we're going to, and we have at the Guggenheim already, we've kind of sat down and demanded better, and we're making progress.
Before we talk about the response from the administration at the museum, I think a lot of people outside of some major metropolitan areas where unions are still fairly ubiquitous, or at least as much as they can be, may not understand how unions work. And so I think I'd like our listeners to kind of get a sense of what you do as a union organizer. You don't work for the Guggenheim, you work for the union. Talk about, you know, what you do, and talk us through that process a little bit about, you know, what is a union? Why does it matter? How do you kind of organize something like this? Just to kind of give people a baseline, because a lot of people ask me, you know, why would a union work with a museum? Why would a museum need a union? Even what is a union? You know, because it's just something you don't see as much in big parts of the country.
So on a very basic level, a union is the workers at a museum, for example, or at another workplace. And that really is what the union is. It's a group of workers that come together to improve their wages, improve their working conditions, improve their benefits, and to have security on the job. And so what's really important, I want people to understand here, and especially in the example of the Guggenheim, is being unionized is not up to management. It's not up to the bosses, right? If it was, there probably wouldn't be very many unions out there. But this is a federal right. And workers have every right in the world to come together and say, hey, let's build a union here, let's join with the union and sit down with management and negotiate the things that we want. And it's only through that process that management's, you know, at institutions and, you know, cultural institutions or really any industry that management is legally obligated to sit down with their workers and their union and negotiate the working conditions that matter to these group of workers, to these employees. It is not the choice of someone like me, who's a union representative. It is not the choice of a supervisor or management. It is exclusively the choice of the people that work there. And so I agree. Unions outside of metropolitan, even within metropolitan areas, are not as prevalent as they once were. Certainly in parts of the country, they're far less prevalent. But anywhere, in the private sector or in the public sector, depending on state laws, that workers want to come together and say, we want to sit down with the CEO and talk about our wages, they have the right to do that. And that's what, it might surprise some people to hear that. And I guess the union movement's doing everything it can to scream that from the mountaintops. But even organizing artists at the Guggenheim, they were unaware that they had these rights. And when we did start to talk about this and say, hey, look, there are things you could do about this. We have to come together. We have to unionize. They were surprised to learn that, you know, they had this power to force the museum leadership to the table and talk about the issues they want to talk about. So all a union is the workers in a workplace that come together and say, hey, look, we want to improve our work lives and our work-life balance, as you mentioned. And someone like me, I'll show up and say, hey, you can do it. Let me teach you how to do it. You know, the operating engineers, Local 30, which is our union, supports you 100%. Our union leadership supports you 100%. And together, we're going to make sure that you get a better deal at work.
So let's talk about, you know, because of course, we're talking to you and you represent the union. So that's one side of the thing. But I'm curious, sure, what kind of pushback was there from the brass at the museum, if any? Were workers concerned that this would put them in an awkward position if they made this choice? Of course, you know, having other museums in the New York area that were already unionized set some sort of precedent. So it wasn't as if this was out of left field. I'm sure the people at the Guggenheim had considered that this may be a possibility. But talk a little bit about it from the kind of administrative side and how this was received initially.
So the way this worked is, you know, by the time we, you know, we kept it very quiet. It's just the smartest way to approach building a union at first, right? Because it's the workers kind of talking it out amongst themselves. When we advised the Guggenheim that the workers were unionizing and that they had, you know, the federal right to do so, and that us as the union were supporting them and would go to the National Labor Relations Board and file the appropriate paperwork, the museum was surprised. And they had a choice to make. And, you know, the choice is either, okay, you know, we'll figure out how to make this unionization effort easy on employees, or we'll fight them on it. And the Guggenheim chose to fight them on it. Now, when I say fight them, there are very limited things that employers can do during a unionization drive. Like I mentioned, the workers are protected. So, you know, there can't be any firings, for example, or threats, or, you know, all of that stuff violates the National Labor Relations Act. But what they did do was hire a very high-priced law firm to try to talk the workers out of it. And so management held, for example, many meetings over the course of a month where they paid some of the workers to come in and listen to a four-hour meeting about why the union was such a bad idea, why the union wouldn't work, why the union couldn't guarantee them anything. In negotiations, for example, and really tried to apply pressure on these 140 workers that were eligible to vote. The outcome was that the workers voted over 75% in favor of the union. And so, yes, management.
Can you give me a sense of the timeline of this whole process and when this all occurred,
sure, yeah,
and over what time period?
Sure. The election was in mid-June. And like I said, we started talking to the workers in earnest and really getting the ball rolling in January, February, early March, all in 2019. And it happens very fast. The government has very strict timelines between the time workers say, we want a union, and the time that there's an actual election in the workplace. And that's about 30 to 35 days. So it happens very fast. But yeah, this was all done in about 6 months, I would say, from the very first conversation to the vote.
So, you know, when you're seeing that kind of pushback and, you know, the administration is saying, you know, let's sit down and talk through this. Maybe there's another path, and that path is a non-union path. And was there any second thoughts on behalf of the workers to say, hey, maybe we should slow this down and consider what, you know, the administration is offering? Or was it just full speed ahead, we're doing this, we're not going to kind of get into negotiations at this point, it's happening regardless?
In a unit of 140 people, right, there's always going to be some kind of second thoughts when it's very intimidating for management to, you know, to be in front of you and the HR reps and say, well, this is a very bad idea. And, you know, the director of the Guggenheim, who's a globally recognized person in the community, came out and said, we don't think you need a union here. And so, of course, that's going to lead to some people feeling like, hey, maybe this isn't the right choice. However, the workers really ran with this. I mean, there were leaders that said, we can expect management not to want a union because intuitively we know that it's going to cost them control. And what management has had in every non-union workplace is total control. And the union is a threat to that. There's no doubt about it. But the workers having a say in their working conditions is, you know, obviously good for them. And so the one metric that we can go by is the vote on how people felt about the union. And again, it was over 75% in favor.
So when you have 75% of the whole, does the organization require 100% participation by the staff to move forward? If you do have holdouts, are they still the people that didn't want to do it, of course, still have the protections of the union if the organization moves forward? How does it end up dealing with the kind of split within the staff? Because I would imagine even to this day, there may be still people on staff at any museum that's unionized who maybe, you know, don't really think that was the best decision or not. You know, how does that all work out?
So in New York, you know, New York is not a right to work state. I believe actually Oklahoma is.
Yes.
I know you're calling me from Tulsa.
Yeah.
So,
what is a right to work state, by the way?
Like I said, the right to unionize is a federal law. And so it's all 50 states. A right to work state is, you know, where if you're in a union shop and you say, well, look, I don't support the union and I don't really want to pay any dues to the union or what they call financial core. And so I'm just going to opt out of the union in my workplace. In right-to-work states, you're allowed to do that. However, the union still has to protect you. The union still has to defend you, just like it would defend a union member in that workplace. And you still receive the benefits of unionization. In other words, the contractually negotiated wage, the contractually negotiated benefits, the protections from being laid off, the protections from being fired without cause. You still enjoy all of those benefits, even if you opt out of membership and decide, you know, not to pay into the union dues, the minimal union dues that protect the contract. New York is not a right-to-work state, which basically means, although you don't have to be a union member in any state, you have what's called Beck rights, which is essentially an objector status. In New York, you do have to contribute to the collective defense through what's called a financial core. So union members will pay X amount in dues. And if you say, well, I don't agree with the union for my own political or religious, you know, beliefs, then you don't have to become a member, but you also have to contribute to the union.
Right. So thanks for explaining that. I think that's just good for people to kind of know how that all works. But back to your point about kind of how people move forward if there's any kind of split within the staff and how they kind of work together.
Yeah. So there is, you're right, in a unit this size, inevitably there are people that are hesitant or perhaps didn't support the union. But at the end, the contract that's negotiated by their peers, by their coworkers, with, of course, us in the room and our, like I said before, our union, the Operating Engineers Local 30, supports them fully, including lawyers if we need them and all that kind of stuff. Whatever contract comes out of these negotiations, everybody is protected by that contract. No one opts out of that contract. Everyone receives the same benefits that get negotiated. And for us, at least, we will not have a union contract unless the workers vote it up. That's called a ratification vote. So right now, as we speak, we're negotiating with the Guggenheim. There are, you know, 9 to 11 of the workers that work there on the committee in the room negotiating every single session. They're a part of the discussions. They're agreeing to whatever, you know, articles we wind up agreeing to or whatever conditions we wind up agreeing to. It's really all worker-led with the full support of the union.
This episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Conceptual Art. What is conceptual art? Or, put another way, what isn't conceptual art? Perhaps this very podcast is a form of conceptual art, and thus is ironically commenting on or satirizing or critiquing or investigating this or that aspect of blah, blah, blah. Or else it's deconstructing the thinking behind blah, blah, blah. Or maybe questioning what we talk about when we talk about blah, blah, blah. Or simply exploring the concept behind what it means to think about blah, blah, blah. Or what it used to mean, what it might mean, what it should mean. And do I have to think about conceptual art in the same way that you do? And if not, why not? What are we really talking about or thinking about? And by the way, how can we even tell good conceptual art from bad conceptual art? And if, as Hamlet once famously lamented, nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so, then does the concept of the meaning of conceptual art really matter? Does conceptual art mean anything? Anything at all? Conceptual art. Think it through. Or think it over. Or think again. Or think not. Now you're getting somewhere.
I think so many of the negative perceptions that people may have about unions, of course, comes from media. And I'm thinking about, you know, we have this new film, The Irishman, out, right? And people still are locked into this 20th century, mid-century notion of what unions are and Jimmy Hoffa and all this stuff. And these conversations seem to just kind of never end. But the 21st century union has got to be so much more progressive and just different than what people may think about when they're reading, you know, The Jungle, or they're watching some, you know, movie or television thing from 1955 or 1975. How do you kind of go about combating any kind of negative notions of what a union is, and also kind of talking about how unions grow and change with the times?
Yeah, it's never been a very union-friendly, you know, media environment for trade unions, that's for sure. I will say that trade unions have done a tremendous amount to give working people middle-class lives, right? And that's really what we do, what we're committed to and dedicated to, is making sure people have enough to eat, you know, have enough to pay their mortgage, to pay their rent, have some job protections. The workplace is so incredibly unfair. Working people have so little control over their daily lives that what we're trying to do is give working people some of that control back. You know, their families matter just as much as the CEO's families matter. And that's what we tell them. You know, when it comes to perceptions of unions, again, like you mentioned, in New York City, unions are more popular, more prevalent here. And so everyone kind of knows somebody that's in a union, and they can make their own judgments on what their jobs are like, and they build sort of this internal understanding of trade unions. But in the Guggenheim example, it wasn't until we really started moving here and these workers saw firsthand that they were in control of this campaign, and it was their issues that mattered, and it was their concerns that mattered, and their voice that was going to be strengthened, that whatever perceptions they had of trade unions went away from these experiences, right? And so the only promise we make people that are joining our union is, hey, you're going to have a voice, and we're going to support that voice, and things are going to get better. And that's the promise. And, you know, we're keeping that promise here and in other places we unionize.
So last question is this. When I believe, to the, you know, MoMA and Guggenheim have both unionized. I believe the New Museum has also unionized recently. And I don't know of other museums in New York, but do you see this as something that as each museum organizes that you'll just see that more and more throughout museums, at least in the city? Do you think, are you guys being approached by other cultural institutions similarly to say, hey, maybe this is something we need to be looking into? Or is it going to be kind of on a case-by-case basis?
Yeah, this is really happening here. I think, you know, one of the mantras of the of our campaign this summer was loving where you work and loving the work you do is not mutually exclusive from having a decent life, right? And so the message in New York, in the cultural industry institutions, is spreading that, hey, these jobs do not have to be bad jobs. They should not be bad jobs just because you love the art world. These should be good jobs. They're jobs nonetheless, and the only way to make them better is to unionize. And so, yeah, we're talking to, you know, installers and all types of museum workers in other locations. Like I said, the last real significant non-union museum in New York City was the Guggenheim. And now that that's unionized and we're negotiating a contract, I think, you know, workers at galleries are going to be reaching out saying, hey, let's just make this a better industry for not only the institutions and the art world, but for the workers of the institutions.
The Art Workers Coalition, or AWC, was a collection of American artists, dealers, museum workers, and other workers in the art industry. On October 15, 1969, the group organized a successful, quote, moratorium of art to end the war in Vietnam. The Museum of Modern Art, the Whitney Museum, the Jewish Museum, and a large number of commercial art galleries closed for the day. The Metropolitan Museum and the Guggenheim Museum did not comply. Under pressure from the group, the Metropolitan postponed the opening of its American Painting and Sculpture Show scheduled for that day, and the Guggenheim got picketed. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.